The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Thursday, the 30th of May, 2019. On the podcast today, I have Dr. Dan Gooding, Chief Executive Officer of Nuformix, NFX. And Dan discusses the significance of the positive results for the NXP001 clinical trial. The share price has really been going stratospheric of late. Also on the podcast, Aidan Bishop, founder of Big Dish at DISH, and Aidan talks through the launch of their nationwide rollout. Plus, I have Neil Ricketts, Chief Executive Officer of Vesarin, who provides an update on their collaboration agreement with BP Polymers. And also, Chris Bailey, founder of FinancialOrbit.com, talks about First Group, Johnson Matthey, and Watches of Switzerland, who listed today. And as always, I have two lists for you, the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs. By the way, you can see this and lots of other content at voxmarkets.co.uk. Plus, do us a favour. If you use the app, by all means, repay the service, because it's free for you, of course, but if you get value from it, by all means, give us a decent rating and review at your app store. Thanks a lot.
Want to get live push notification alerts whenever a company you follow releases an RNS? Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Dr. Dan Gooding, CEO of Nuformix. NFX is the ticker. Dan, thanks for joining me.
My pleasure, Justin.
Do you know what? I've just actually tweeted out a chart, and yesterday I did cover your chart in a video as well, and it's been a phenomenal rise. Last 2 months now. I mean, when I tweeted out the chart, it was up 28% a day, but I said that's about 450% in the last 2 months. And so congratulations, you're doing very well. And today's news, of course, is the news that everyone's been waiting for, positive results on NXP001 on the clinical trial, and we'll get into that in a bit. But as always, Dan, I don't want to, you know, just start on chapter two for people who are not aware of the story. So give us a brief summary. Nuformix, could you explain for people new to the company, not familiar, what's all about, please?
Yeah, of course. Well, thanks for that intro for a start. Firstly, I would say that Nuformix, for anyone that's not heard about the company before, we're a pharmaceutical development company with a twist. Pharmaceutical development means that we take products through pharmaceutical development processes through to a point of proof of concept. And our business model is then to out-license those products after they've having proved their utility in a certain disease or commercial opportunity. But what we do is slightly different, in that we only work with known drugs. And that gives us a slightly different risk profile than you'd usually associate with companies that follow the more traditional biotech model of starting with new molecules and having to prove their safety and utility in a variety of different clinical studies.
Yeah, and that's the key, isn't it? That's what a lot of people, I think, didn't get at the start, because people just say, oh, so it's a biotech company or a pharmaceutical company or whatever. And like, you don't have that, you know, that very expensive long runway through phase one, two, and three, all self-funded. You've got a drug before that's, you know, previously proven, and you're just adjusting it in some way. So like I say, it's lower risk, lower cost, faster market, you license it out, and this is what's happening with NXP1. So take us through this bioequivalence. What does this mean now then, Dan?
Yeah, sure. So what we were very keen to do right from the start when we finally got Nuformix with the opportunity to get into clinical development was to demonstrate our technology was translatable into humans quite quickly. One way to do that was to actually, instead of developing a entirely new product from scratch and having to prove it in a complicated clinical study, we could identify that there was one product out there where being able to produce a generic version of that product was technically very difficult to do. Also, it was difficult because of some of the IP that was in that space, preventing other companies from getting into that space. So there was a drug out there, which we term NXP001, which is a treatment for chemotherapy-induced nausea and vomiting. We've conducted a study that demonstrates that using a co-crystal approach, which is built upon some of the patents that the companies filed, we can actually achieve bioequivalence to the marketed product using a completely different approach. So it's a relatively short, ineffective, inexpensive study, but allows us to move very quickly into having products on the market that use our technology.
So take us through this. So first of all, you get this the final milestone payment of $2 million from your Chinese licensing partner. Of course, you get 10% royalty, and you now can go to the rest of the world with the rights for this. And I assume, is it like for like? I've said previously, the rest of the world is probably three times the size of China. So could you measure the metrics on milestones and royalty payments in that respect?
Yeah, I think, you know, the kind of size of the deal that we'll be able to do in the future will be determined by, you know, that opportunity. I think you're right, as a metric. China's a very unique opportunity, certainly in the oncology space, because although it's home to one-fifth of the world's population, it's actually home to one-third of the world's cancer patients. So it's got a unique opportunity in terms of oncology. But I think, you know, as a metric, we'd look to do between 3 to 5 times, you know, that in terms of looking at rest of world rights, particularly focusing on looking at European rights and US rights. They're the key markets.
Yeah, and that's and the significance here is not just that of the rest of the world and that Chinese. You say it finalizes further product development opportunities. What do you mean by that?
Sure. So anyone that's perhaps looked at companies like Nuformix might have heard of the concept of reprofiling, where we're able to take drugs from one indication and find that they've got some utility in another disease. There are potentially some opportunities for us to do that with NXP1 as well. But our key focus at the moment now, having delivered this result, is to take the product towards registration in China through our partner, NuSemit Bio, but also to focus on finding other partners for other territories. That will become our main focus for NXP1.
Yeah, and like I said, this also is the first time you've achieved this in clinical studies there, so it does sort of validate your approach here and your business model, and of course,
absolutely, yeah,
your pipeline as well. So you got other things going on. So are you also looking at other sort of drugs, other products as well, or what?
Oh, continually. I mean, you're absolutely right. You know, we're lucky enough to be connected to some really experienced people in the space, thanks largely to being based in the Cambridge area. And one of our advisors first said to me when we became a clinical development company, you know, the first rule of biotech is your first clinical study has to work. And you know, I'm just really pleased that we've been able to deliver exactly that, because it is validating for everything else that we want to do. And we are constantly looking for new areas to, you know, apply our technology. And you know, as people that are familiar with the Nuformix story, they'll be aware of the Ebus deal that we've done in the cannabinoid space. And that, you know, kind of activity was born out of exactly us doing just that, looking for, you know, really innovative ways to apply our technology to other molecules. And so we have NXP2, which is also now going to become a major focus for us in the fibrosis space. Now that we've reached this point with NXP1, we've also got the EBAS activities, as I've said. Now, behind that, we've got the work we've been doing, looking for other opportunities to apply technology to other molecules, other disease areas. And now we've reached this point in time, with revenues coming in, I think we can start being a bit more ambitious about how we might like to be building our portfolio.
Yeah, exactly. And as well as looking outwards, do you get sort of incoming interest as well? People looking at this and what have you?
I have to say, I think that does happen occasionally. The majority of, you know, biz development activities, you know, you have to be a bit more proactive. There are some really exciting opportunities out there. You know, we talked about cannabinoids. Another really exciting area is that of AI, artificial intelligence. So people will be familiar with how that is starting to become important within the pharmaceutical and biotech field. We've spoken to a number of, you know, technology specialists in this area. Nothing's quite come of it yet, but on paper, this idea of being able to use, you know, algorithms to interpret existing data and find links between unmet needs and molecules that might be effective in treating them is a really good match with our ability to generate new IP and really improve how that drug might work. So that's an area where we're currently, you know, outwardly seeking partners to link up with, as I think those two areas, AI and ourselves, complement each other really well. So maybe that gives you a flavour of some of the things that, you know, people might hear going forwards.
I like the sound of AI. But as far as news is concerned now, we'll have more news, I suppose, from NXP 1 and NXP 2 and the cannabinoid as well. Will we have news from that soon?
Absolutely, yeah. We'll be keeping the market informed. As I've said, you know, this is always a kind of a watershed moment for us, really, the catalyst for us to be ambitious about what we could really now start to achieve with the rest of our portfolio. Thankfully, as of today's results, it looks like we're going to be given that opportunity. So we can now start to think about, you know, exactly all of the opportunities that we've been working on, you know, picking all of the winners from those and progressing those to the next stage of development and hopefully value inflection.
Yeah, exactly. What's your ambition here for New Frontworks, Dan?
Well, as I've always said, you know, my ambition is really to stick with the company's ethos, and that is finding ways to effectively cost-effective and risk-reduce drug development. I've got no plans to change that and build a complex company doing high-risk clinical studies using loads of really expensive people. We're going to selectively optimize what we have in the portfolio, look for the right ways of developing a handful of those assets to reach a really significant inflection point, you know, maybe 2 to 3 to 4 assets within our portfolio. Long-term view is ultimately a trade sale.
Yeah. And is it any point in me asking you how big this will be?
Well, I think, you know, I really encourage people, like yourself, to do their own research. And I think, you know, we've got a very interesting opportunity in the fibrosis space. It's not difficult, you know, for people to Google, you know, fibrosis out-licensing deals and look at some of the things that have happened within that space, even at very early stages of development. So, that's, you know, the kind of opportunity that we would like to be able to emulate. You know, if we're able to do that with multiple assets, you know, that'd be a really exciting position to get ourselves into.
Marvellous stuff. One final thing, then, Dan, as always, your three reasons, if someone's listening right now, why they should hit that follow button on your page and add you to their watch list, please.
Yeah, of course. So the first thing I'd say is, we've now, as of today's results, been able to prove our technology, having been able to translate our technology successfully into humans. Secondly, we've been able to prove our business model, that we can do deals early on, generate non-dilutive income and reinvest that back into R&D. Lastly, I'd say, you know, with those two things having been established, we now have the opportunity to apply all of that to our wider portfolio.
Yeah, and you guys have got skin in the game, which is always very good, you know. And that's, you know, as an investor, I always look at that, always, you know.
Yes, I imagine you might, and you know, that started to get, you know, exciting for all of the team here. But you know, it's not, you know, by chance or by accident. You know, we started the company 10 years ago. We're starting to see how, you know, the risks of deciding to take, you know, our products forward ourselves into clinical development, it's starting to pay off. And that's obviously really exciting for everyone involved.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, listen, I did ask you for three reasons there, but listen, you're already today, you are the most followed company on Vox Markets. People can check that out at voxmarkets.co.uk. So, and it's been up there quite a few times in the last few weeks. So well done, but no doubt.
Thank you.
I expect after today's rise, even more people are following the story, because this is pretty much just a start, isn't it, I suppose?
I'd like to think so, yeah. It's certainly a moment, it's a litmus test moment. You know, can we translate our technology successfully into a human clinical study? And yes, we've done that. And now we're going to be looking at, you know, really how we can utilize that, how we can redeploy revenues from this event, revenues from other deals, into really increasing the value further of the assets that we have in the company.
Marvellous stuff. Dan, thanks for that. And hopefully we'll be catching up in the not-too-distant future. Thanks a lot.
I look forward to that. Thanks, Justin, as ever.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Aidan Bishop, founder of Big Dish. That's D-I-S-H. Aidan, thanks for joining me.
You're welcome.
And I've got to say, I did a video yesterday looking at some of the charts, and there's a couple of tech stocks at the moment, and they're doing very well. Your chart was one of them. Really good momentum, strength there, just based on the recent news flow you've had coming out. And you certainly are picking up a pace as far as your rollout strategy. And we'll dig into that in a bit. But as always, I don't want to leave people behind. So if there's anyone listening who has not heard you or not quite familiar with what Big Dish is all about, could you just please explain, Aidan, what you do there?
Yeah, Big Dish is a restaurant booking platform in the last minute market. So you can book a seat on Big Dish up to 48 hours in advance. And for consumers, every seat on Big Dish has either a 25% discount, a 50% discount, or a 2-for-1. So the consumer, very simply, within 3 taps, has an instantly confirmed booking at a restaurant of their choice. And that's our proposition to consumers. It's a free app. To restaurants, restaurants are able to put on their excess availability. So what they know when they're busy, they know when they're not busy. So in their less busy periods, or if they suddenly have empty tables, they put them on the Big Dish app, a certain number of seats at specified discounts, and those are made available to the Big Dish community.
Yeah, and there's a third angle here. I like the simplicity of this. It's obvious. You know, I've said several times, it's to anyone who likes going out and eating, who, let's be honest, who doesn't, you may as well have the app. You know, you could get a discount on food you otherwise wouldn't get. And obviously the restaurateur gets extra people coming in and buying meals. And also the third angle, like someone pointed out, is actually, no one likes to go into an empty restaurant. You know, so you want to see people, you know, even at quiet times. It's nice to see that a restaurant is quite popular, because that means it's doing very well, or it's a recommendation in a way. So it's a no-brainer. So let's go into the rollout. You've accelerated quite quickly, so you're rolling out nationwide. What does this mean?
Well, what this simply means is up to now, we've been operating in 2 territories, which are in the southwestern UK, and we're quite pleased actually the way it's developed, because we focus initially on independent restaurants and small group restaurants. So when I look at like a competitor of ours, they have slightly more restaurants in the regions where we're in, but there's a majority of chain restaurants, and we haven't even started going for the chains yet. So you know, it's going well. We're pleased with how things are progressing, and I think we've been sort of telling the market, or hinting to the market, that today was coming, because, you know, it's time for us to go nationwide. And that means we're doing a rollout. We're doing it as a single initiative. We're going to be recruiting 10 territory managers, and, you know, we'll start seeing new locations, new regions going live on Big Dish. Over the next few months, it's going to be an exciting time. It's going to be great to see the opportunity for Big Dish shareholders to become Big Dish users around the UK.
Yeah, and you're saying here, because obviously you're a tech company, additionally the company will develop new search functionality. What's all that about then?
Ah, so that's quite important. So one of the things we noticed was on the app, but you have to, you know, select a location. Mm-hmm. And with all the new locations coming on board, that list is going to become rather long. Yeah. So it was originally set up that way for large age to just to be in large cities only, but we're going to do something that's much more intuitive, much better user experience, and that'll be coming over a couple of months, and it'll be a real smooth search functionality. It will improve everybody's user experience, and it will also free up some space within the app, physical sort of visual space, and make way for new functionality that will be developed.
Okay. Sanj, the CEO, Sanj Nahar, CEO, says we continue to improve our app and the user experience and are looking forward to announcing our next upcoming partnership, which will help drive the business forward. That's any clues there at all?
We actually said, I think we announced last week that we were going to announce that this week, and it's not quite ready there. Still, it's getting there. It's almost there, and that's to coincide with the launch in Brighton. So it's something related to that.
Okay, and is there a restaurant or food group based in Brighton, or what's that?
No. We said on the RNS today, it's a UK tech platform.
Ah, okay, cool. All right, marvellous. Well, it's certainly going well. Now, do you know what? People sometimes don't get tech. They don't understand what you're trying to do. And I've had a couple of people saying, well, I don't understand how this is viable, because you're charging, what, is it £1 per person seated? And so they said, even if you extrapolate that over lots of restaurants, you're not going to make a whole heck of, bunch of money. So, I, you know, it's worth pointing out things like Uber and all that stuff.
Yeah. they missed the point completely. Completely missed it. I mean, if those were the metrics that people use, we wouldn't have many tech companies in the world today, and there wouldn't be much innovation. Also, the model we're using, it's not a new model, right? Charging diners, diners per seat is not new. TripAdvisor's booking platform has been doing this for quite some time. So, look, if people don't think the model works, they better call up TripAdvisor, tell them to close down their booking platform, because it's been working. And other tech companies as well that have similar type of booking systems at restaurants, and it's very similar. The other thing as well to realize is this is not all about just diners seated. That is not the only revenue stream. That is the initial revenue stream, but there are so many more revenue streams coming to Big Dish. And we'll see them this year. We will see them this year, I'm pretty sure. And you know, it's going to be very interesting. But this is all about our footprint increasing the number of Big Dish users, increasing the number of restaurants, generating really rich data. This is where the value is.
Yeah, and I suppose at the end of the day, like you say, you are trying to disrupt here. And when you become a disruptor, then one of the big players will take you out, I assume. Is that the aim?
Well, look, I mean, you never know when that's going to happen, but I have, in my discussions with Sanj, and of course Sanj was a TripAdvisor, he was a Booker Table, and he knows these guys, so I sort of picked his brain and said, Sanj, at what point in time does Big Dish become on the radar of big players like that? So, you know, it's and I can also look at acquisitions that have been done, investments that have been done by those large players into other platforms. And I think somewhere around the 500 to 1,000 restaurant mark, we're going to have some quite serious interest from some interesting players.
Yeah, cool. Exactly. I mean, I've said a lot of times, you have to get a critical mass going, but it's nice to see the pace at which you're rolling this out. That's very encouraging. And like I say, it's such a simple idea, and simplicity is genius, And a lot of people, I think it's humans who try and complicate things, And I always go back to an example when people try and do things. I say, look at Google. It came along, everyone had search engines with lots of stuff on the front page, and all of a sudden Google came along, simplified it, and with one page, one bar, one search, well, two buttons, that's it. So the simplicity is a genius here, isn't it? It's a no-brainer for both parties,
Yeah, and we want to keep it that way. I mean, we want to keep simplicity at the heart of everything we do. Three taps, you can make an instantly confirmed booking. That's it. We have always got to maintain that sense of simplicity towards the consumer, because it's so easy to understand and people get it. And as long as we keep doing that, keep doing it well and keep growing, the future is bright.
Yeah, marvellous stuff. Cool. Okay, three reasons then, Aidan, as to why someone should tap the follow button on Vox Markets and add you to their watch list, please.
Well, my reason 1, 2, and 3 today is quite simple. Big Dish is expanding around the UK. It's coming to a town or city near you. Become a Big Dish shareholder, become a Big Dish user. There we go.
Marvellous stuff. Aidan, good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll be catching up in a not-too-distant future. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Neil Ricketts, CEO of Vasarian. VRS is ticker there. Neil, thanks for joining me.
Good morning, Justin. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
Yeah, you announced update, the collaboration agreement with BP Polymers yesterday. And let's dig into that. And before we do, as always, I hate doing this because you've done it so many times, but there's always new people to the podcast. I know that because I get feedback all the time. But just for people not familiar with Vasarian, just summarise the company, please, if you could, Neil.
Yeah, sure. So formed in 2011, it's an advanced materials company which takes IP from great UK universities like Manchester and Cambridge and turns them into commercial products. One of the things that we're working on at the moment is graphene, which obviously is this new wonder material, which is starting to make its way out of the laboratory and into everyday items.
Yeah, marvellous stuff. Okay, so take us through this, this collaboration with BP Polymers. Who are they? What's it all about then?
BP Polymers are a large American corporation, over 20 sites in the US, one of the top 10 blow molded plastic producers. So when we say plastic, if you think about bottles that contain shampoos, chemicals, those kind of things, they're all blow molded. They're all made from specific types of plastic. And that's what this company does. And they do it for large companies, the likes of some of the big fast food outlets, right the way through to the oil and gas companies. And basically, if you make it and you need to store it, these are the guys that make the stuff that that it sits in.
Okay, all right. And what's going on from here? Where does this go from here? What's next here?
So BPP are a large blow molding company. They make containers for a lot of the large fast food chains, petrochemical companies. Basically, if you make it and you need to store it, you put it in one of their kind of containers. So they're in the top 10 of their particular field in the US. Big company, 20 odd sites. Great company for us to work on. And the good thing for us is that we've already done a lot of that technology. We already know about putting graphene into polymers to improve flame retardancy, tensile strength, and a lot of the other properties like permutation and things like that. So it's a good application for us, but it's not one of our top five at the moment. Our top five is still progressing with the core team. This is something that's going on with the ancillary team below.
So can you elaborate on the top five? What does that mean?
So we've got five opportunities at the moment where we're working with global companies to bring new products to market. And what I would call the top teams are David and myself and Steve focused on everything we need to do to get those top five to production. They range from construction to textiles and clothing. So a huge breadth across even just those five, but those are the five that are going to make a transformational change to the business that we believe. And so nothing has changed. We're still focused on those five. Obviously, there's a huge amount of opportunities. It's not a day goes by when we don't learn of another opportunity. But those opportunities tend to be things that we've already done a lot of the work on. And so they go through our ancillary team, and they don't have quite as quite a challenge as the big five. So
And is that the way you sort of keep an eye? I mean, because you've done a lot of I've lost count of the collaborations you've done now, and agreements here. So is that a way you sort of filter the process so you can keep a focus on the important stuff and prioritize?
Yeah. So some of the stuff is it requires research. It requires, you know, it's a fundamental change to the way that we produce these materials. So they tend to go to the research team through Steve, who's based down in Cambridge. Then we have opportunities that we already know how to do, and they go through the kind of ancillary team. They're kind of almost like bread and butter type opportunities. You know, can you take graphene? Can you put it into this technology? And can it make this improvement? Yes, we've already done either very, very similar work or exactly the same work with other people. We don't have any exclusivities in place. And so those opportunities go through our ancillary team. And then we have the core five, which we believe are transformational for the business, and they are marshaled and mentored by the senior managers themselves, David, Steve, Matt, and Chris. And those are the ones which we're obviously most keen on getting into production. They tend to be large volumes for large global customers in really key industries and technologies. So, as I said before, anything from construction to textiles.
Yeah. And geographically, you seem to be centering on two areas, which are obviously the two biggest economies in the world, pretty much, the US and China. Maybe you could help with the trade talks there, Neil. I don't know. But how's it going in China? How's it going in America?
China is all on track, no issues at all. We're still pushing for our timeline. There's no issues at the trade talks and things like that. The impact of any kind of global economics doesn't make any difference to us at all. And the team under Matt, with help from DIT, are absolutely concentrating on that deal. Matt is also busy in South Korea. He's also making great headroom in Japan, which is traditionally a difficult business to, or a difficult market to get into. And then, of course, I've just come back from Washington. We've had a fantastic event out there with the National Graphene Association, talking on Capitol Hill with senators, you know, key decision makers. We're in a great position there, being the only globally verified company in the world. And, you know, that gives a lot of confidence, especially to our American audience, that actually what we're producing is going to be fit for purpose and going to be, you know, what it says on the tin. And so Patrick is as busy as hell. And to be honest, you know, I wish he'd slow down a little bit, because my work day is just getting longer and longer and longer. But he's doing some great stuff there. The reason that we announced this was it was announced in the US at the same time. It was announced in California at 7 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, we're a global company now. So we've got lots going on across 4 or 5 different territories and opportunities springing up all the time. So, again, we're focused on 5 key product introductions. We're also focused on 5 key territories, and that's China, Europe, the US, Japan, and South Korea.
Yeah.
So lots and lots going on.
Yeah, absolutely. Marvellous stuff. Okay. Well, Neil, as you know, there's one final thing I'll ask you to do here. If someone likes the sound of the progress you're making but are not following the story as yet, give them those 3 quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page and add you to their watch list, please.
Not a problem. We're the only verified global graphene company under the Graphene Council's very stringent testing regime, which means that we've got a great tick in the box as far as proving our reliability and repeatability of our processes. We have adapted over the last 12 months to move from a UK-based company to being international in terms of having activities going on in China, Japan, South Korea, obviously the UK and Europe and the US. And finally, I'm the largest holder, and therefore all of my aims and ambitions for the company over the next period of time are all aligned with those of the long-term holders.
Yeah, marvellous stuff. Neil, good to chat to you. And no doubt we'll be chatting to you in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
Thanks very much, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Chris Bailey, founder of FinancialOrbit.com. You're right, Chris.
Very good, thanks. Very good.
What's it like being in the bigger market there? Because sometimes they don't, you know, sometimes they're not connected. The small cap space and the big cap space can be, you know, I've seen small caps fly and the big caps fall and vice versa, you know. So what's it like at the moment?
Yeah, it's not easy. I mean, the all-pervading thing is not Brexit. It's not European angst, as you would think from, you know, events of the last few weeks, few months, few years, let's face it, in this country. That the big issue impacting global stocks, because let's face it, you know, 2/3 of the UK FTSE 100's profits come from overseas. You know, they don't come from the UK. The big issue around the world is this world trade angst. And, you know, when the US and China go at each other, they're two huge economies. That has repercussions and implications. So that's what's sort of hassling, if you like, sentiment towards larger cap stocks around the world. And obviously that's impacting the FTSE 100 and names within.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I know it's dragging on, isn't it? And using Trump and China and all that stuff, and it doesn't seem to be easing up. But, you know, it can turn on the flip of a coin, can't it, really? You know, it could...
That's right. I mean, and you think about the incentives for it, right? Trump, if he wants to win the 2020 election, he's got to have an all right US economy. And guess what? If you have a world trade war, that's a fast forward to more difficult economic times, which isn't good. And China's got a bit more flexibility. They don't have elections, of course, but, you know, they still are trying to change their economy. And for them, sort of an external backdrop, a global backdrop, which is not dire, not terrible, just makes life a lot easier. So there are incentives to do it. Obviously, there's face, there's negotiation, there's credibility around that and all of that stuff. And that's what you're hearing at the moment. You know, you're talking big, but how big's the stick that you're actually really carrying? And I actually think that the scope for a bit of compromise chat, at least to push some of these issues aside and therefore get sort of economies and world markets a little bit happier, it does exist, but it's going to need some political goodwill.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the closer we get to the presidential elections, the more chance we get of seeing a deal happening. But okay, let's get into individual stocks. What's been happening the last couple of days, yeah. Chris?
Well, got to take a quick look at First Group. I mean, First Group is obviously well known in this country for its rail and bus operations. It's obviously caught the wrath of all, as all rail operators have, frankly, of the government, who are, you know, unhappy with some of the franchise performances and the like. But First Group's story, there's really three key elements to it. The first is that it's got a very good and inherently profitable bus operation, not just the buses you see trundling around country lanes here, but actually in particularly in the States, but also in this country as well, a great student bus business where you've got this very regular school bus transportation stuff. It's a great business, very cash generative and steady. There are some good bits of First Group. The second aspect of First Group, of course, is that previous management completely bogged it up. They turned down a private equity bid a year ago at 120 pence, a level we'll come back to in a sec. And they also loaded the company with too much debt over the last few years. So loads of hassles there. The third aspect, of course, is that activist investors have been circling. Not only did you have this private equity bid last year, but you got another group come in recent months saying, look, there is value in this operation, but management are just running it all wrong. What I find interesting is, look at what First Group said earlier this week. What did they say? They said, we want to split the company up, basically. And they're kind of, if you like, agreeing with everything the activists said, whilst, of course, disagreeing with the activists' other kind of insights, which are the management team should go and everything else. So for me, no surprises to see First Group shares push up in the time after the results publication. This is exactly what shareholders want to hear. But here's the thing, Justin, here's what gets my goat. Just over a year ago, they turned down a bid from private equity at 120 pence. When I last looked at the share price, what was the share kicking around at? 120 pence. It's a massive round trip. You know, as an investor, myself, I'm a shareholder, I've done all right. I bought the share at the sort of the dodgy points 6 months ago, 9 months ago, when nobody believed, at a nice discount to 120p. But your poor old, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Smith sort of longer term shareholder, you know, what they must be thinking, what on earth is going on? We could have had 120p cash this time last year, and maybe we're going to get it by hook or by crook now, maybe a bit more. But, you know, what a waste of time by historic management. And finally, the new management have got a bit of religion and are pushing on this. But there you go, all fun and games at First Group.
Yeah, when was that? That was back in, was it April last year?
That's right. It's basically back in the first quarter of last year. They got
the
bid.
They rose to that, didn't it?
That's right. Yeah. They ummed and erred. There were talk about counter bid. Were they going to need to push above 120, etc.? But they turned it down. The previous management team, most of them are gone now, turned it down and said, no, we can do a better job ourselves. The share price slumped to 80p because people said, look, you know, oh my God, we just don't believe. And there's been the slow renaissance back, activists circling, the new CEO getting a bit of religion, and here we are. What a waste of time, eh? But, you know, for stock pickers, for purse people who like to embrace a bit of risk and whatever, you know, therein lays the opportunity. But for your longer term shareholders, they must be pulling their hair out.
Yeah, absolutely. A year of wasted, basically downwards, you know, so the share price, and then now just getting back to it after a year. So, yeah, what a waste of time. Cool. Okay. Anything else, Chris, there?
Well, got to chat about Johnson. Matthew, you and I talked about this stock a few months ago. You asked me for a company which was going to be sort of had a little bit of dividend yield, longer term prospects, sort of a tuck away for a number of years. And one of the ones I mentioned was JMAT, Johnson & Matthey. And they've come out with numbers in the last couple of days, which seem all right, actually. They haven't, the initial reaction of the shares was to fall slightly, but, you know, they have pushed up in a reasonable manner in the year to date basis. So, you know, that's just a little bit of noise noise around numbers, but inherently what they said is still very in line with that sort of longer term positive positioning. Because as you may recall, Johnson Matthey, you know, obviously historic old name, usually associated with things like refining of precious metals and the like. They've got big agreements with people like Amplats, with obviously the supply of platinum and palladium and the like. So obviously an important player in catalytic converters and related sort of automotive aspects. But they've pushed out into other areas, including some sort of specialty chemicals, some other clean air embracing aspects, and even battery technology. And actually, when I look at JMAT today, it's actually one of the few UK, you know, born and bred companies, I would say, not only clearly a world leader, there's quite a few of those, but actually technologically is in a fascinating place, is actually doing some quite, you know, groundbreaking sort of things. And in terms of big themes out there, things like the rise of electric vehicles, the rise of battery-operated vehicles and related, the importance of clean air, which was reiterated in their numbers, you know, clean air legislation is a big global theme, and they're a beneficiary of that because, as I say, they do work in the catalytic converter and the recycling and related areas. These are all positives. So I would say for long-term investors, no great hassles, and just maybe you might be building up into an opportunity below that 30 quid level, which has been a little bit of a, if you look on the longer term chart, has been sort of a little bit of a an interesting area for the shares. They have been lower than that historically, they have been higher, but you know, as a good old round number, 30 quid is quite striking.
Mm-hmm. Marvellous. Cool. Anything else, Chris?
Well, got to have, earlier this week, we had the IPO of Watches of Switzerland, which I must admit is a company which previously had passed me by, but they've listed on the London market. They floated the shares at 270 pence. When I last looked, the shares were trading at a sensible premium to that. Not too high, but not too low of a bounce either. They're a watch retailer. You go to their website and they will happily sell you a bunch of, predominantly, unsurprisingly given the name, Swiss watch brands. But you know, both new and pre-owned, as they you know, amusingly call it. You know, interesting. You know, in terms of timing, I would say, given that obviously we've talked about angst already in global markets and the like, and clearly things like watch sales, luxury watch sales, could be impacted. And obviously, there's a retail channel here, both online and physical stores. They've got a number of stores in London and other locations. But yeah, one to watch. I mean, quite literally, one to watch indeed. You know, I must admit, I'm not a Swiss watch owner. I don't think I ever will be. But I will be looking at this one as a counter into both retail and luxury trends. And brave of them to IPO rather than, you know, stick in the sidelines of kind of a private company and under the radar and all of that. But one to look at. I think the listing market cap was just shy of 700 million quid. So not a tiddler, but not a large cap either. Kind of somewhere in the middle. So that tells me there's great scope to see a bit of share price vol one way or t'other over the next few months and quarters. So yeah, quite literally one to watch.
Yeah, well, the ticker is WOSG. WOSG. What? That's really odd, isn't it? What's the G for?
I'd have gone for watch, but they had a limited number of sort of mnemonics they can have. Who knows? There's probably some rational there, Justin. Who knows? But
tick or talk, maybe one of those two.
Tick or talk. Oh goodness! Yeah. I don't think we can keep up this sort of watch joke. You know, we're going to have to movement on from it or something. But
time is is our enemy. Yeah, marvellous, Chris. Thanks for that, fella, and we'll catch up next week, fella.
That's a good plan. See you soon.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five, Hemogenics Pharmaceuticals. Hemo's ticker there. Good RNS from the day, up 52%. At four, it's Bidstack. Of course, you know, we all know what BIDS stands for. Okay, at four, it's down 3.8%. A rare down day for bids. At three, Integumin. I did a video covering these yesterday. Some good news there. They are progressing the company. Skin is a ticker, down just 1% a day. At two, Big Dish, up 20% on the news and the rollout. Of course, I talked to Aiden about that on the podcast. And number one, most followed company, is Nuformix, as I mentioned to Dan, up 27% on their RNS there, the positive results. And of course, that's up 450% for the last 2 months. Okay, top five most followed, or most liked RNSs, I should say. At five, Nuformix positive results for NXP One clinical trial. Just shows how under the radar it is. That's number five. Can't believe that. At four, Vasarin, collaboration agreement with BP Polymers. I chat to Neil about that. At three, it's i3 Energy, quite appropriate, i3 Energy investment. At two, United Oil and Gas, final audited results and notice of AGM. And number one is Rehoboth Resources, Parter Well Appraisal Operations Update. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Much appreciated.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.